Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning. We have open phone lines for you. If you have questions in your head about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you don't know where to go to ask those questions, you can call this program in this coming half hour and ask them here if you would like. And we will endeavor to answer them if we can. You can also call if you have a different viewpoint from the host and would like to bring that up for discussion. The number to call is 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. We're going to take first a call from James in Spring Valley, California. James, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. God bless you and your ministry.
Thank you.
Thank you for your answers to the Bible. And I have a question about Jehovah's Witnesses. I've been a born-again Christian for quite a few years, and they're coming to my door quite regularly. And I just want to know how I can lovingly lead them to know that they're in a cult and that they're not going to go to heaven.
Well, there's no secret to, you know, there's not a secret trick that'll help them be converted that I know of. Maybe somebody out there in dealing with Jehovah's Witness through the years have found, some particular technique or argument that really makes them, sets them back on their heels and makes them rethink their position. I've had many conversations with Jehovah's Witnesses through the years, sometimes 3 hours long, sometimes in their own homes, and I'm pretty familiar with their arguments, but I'm also very much aware of, what the Bible would say to correct their arguments. But the problem is not finding the right argument. The problem is their resistance to arguments. They actually are very much indoctrinated. That's why we call the Jehovah's Witnesses a cult. It's because they are mostly mentally enslaved to an organization that tells them what they're allowed to believe and what they're not allowed to believe, what they're allowed to read and what they're not allowed to read. When people have given themselves over to a cult like that, it usually means that they're not thinking freely anymore. They've surrendered that capacity to somebody else. If they're in a church that doesn't require them to surrender their thinking, then they're not in a cult. If they're in a group that makes them think along the lines of the organization, then they are in a cult. My thought is that while there's very many excellent arguments against their positions, and you can easily, if you're good at it, convince yourself that you've made the better point than they've made, that doesn't necessarily win them over. And, just winning an argument isn't really that desirable when you'd rather win a person's soul. And I think that in the case of people like them and maybe other cultists, what you need to do is testify about your own relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, of course, there are theological differences you have with them, and I'm not saying those are not important. What I'm saying is that they don't care. They don't care about the theological differences you have because they've been indoctrinated to believe one thing, and no matter how good your arguments are, they have a mental block up. What may erode that mental block is if they see in you the Spirit of Christ. If you can testify to a life with God and a relationship with Christ that they themselves lack, and they do generally lack that. In fact, the truth is the Jehovah's Witness organization actually teaches them to not expect any kind of subjective gratification from their relationship with God. It's entirely a mental religion. If you say, I felt like God guided me or God spoke to me about this or that, they'll think you're really, into dangerous stuff because God is communicating with you. They believe that God will only communicate through their organization. And so they don't have that kind of relationship with God. They basically follow rules. The organization makes the rules, teaches them what they can believe and what they have to say to people. They teach them very thoroughly what to say to you at your door, what to say in response to you. And so this is really something they're good at. They've been at it a long time. But what they don't have in most cases is any testimony that they can give of knowing God in any way. They know about God. They don't know God. They don't know that you can have a relationship with God or with Jesus. So I would say, although there'd be a great temptation when they're at your door to argue theology with them, and although there are important theological issues where you would differ from them, I don't think you'll get through to them until you can make them thirsty for something they don't have. They do have a theological system whose arguments and proof texts satisfy them. They don't have a relationship with God that would satisfy them. So if you can share with them and show them, you know, that you have a love for God, a love for them, and a dynamic life in relationship to God, then I think this is something that may get through to them, or it may not. But if anything will, it could, because it'll show them that there is something their religion does not provide, doesn't even pretend to provide. And so that would be my suggestion to you, though I can't guarantee that any suggestion will guarantee that you'll win people over. I would say that what I'm suggesting will probably meet a need that they have more than arguments will. And I'm not trying to say arguments are a bad thing, because I actually do believe in arguments, but sometimes you have to make sure that you're not just talking to a brick wall. Let's talk to Wilma from Longdale. Wilma, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about cremation.
Okay.
I have always, from the earliest times of my Christian faith, wanted to be buried whole. But when it came time that my husband and I, because we're getting older, not sick or anything, but we're getting older, and we thought we would make the arrangements, it was so expensive to get buried whole with a casket, whether you were in a, you know, one of those wall unit things or in the ground,
yeah,
that we went with cremation. And at the time, I thought it was okay because I could say that I believe God can do anything, and that he could gather my ashes, not that they're going to be scattered, but, you know, that he could raise us from the dead. I'm thinking of the raising, the resurrection of the dead at some point.
Yeah, well, think about this. Even if your ashes are scattered, this will not necessarily provide any hindrance to God raising you from the dead. Consider if you were not cremated. Suppose instead you died in a burning building and you were burned up that way. Or you are a martyr, burned at the stake, as many Christians have been in the past.
Were they? I mean, they still had bones left over.
Well,
right?
There may have been bones left over, or it depends on how hot the fire is and so forth. They could be burned to ashes for the most part. But the point is that the cells of your body, once they are dead, they deteriorate quickly into much simpler elements. Eventually, you become dust and ashes again anyway. That's, you know, what happens to the physical body. And so it deteriorates. And what's more, those atoms that were once the cells of your body may become the cells of some other creature's body, earthworms or other creatures, you know, that may eat your remains. Then those atoms now are part of their bodies. Or if a tree is growing nearby your grave and its root goes through your body, which sometimes has been known to be the case, and therefore it takes up some of the nutrients from your body into itself, and it produces apples, and somebody eats those apples, so now some of the atoms from your body are in their body, and when they die, in other words, you can't keep track of them. If people are buried at sea, they may be eaten by any number of fishes that go separate ways, and then they're eaten by other fishes. You got to realize that God doesn't have to keep all of your atoms together in one place in order to resurrect you. If he did, then there'd be very little hope for anyone to be resurrected because their atoms have been spread so far and wide within any number of years or centuries after they've died that it'd be the idea of resurrecting them would be just hopeless if God can't do that. Now, what I believe is that God does not have to find all those atoms and put them back together, just like the body you're in right now doesn't have the same cells in it or the same atoms it had 7 years ago. In fact, probably every cell in your body has replaced itself in the past 7 years, which means the cells that were part of you 10 years ago are not part of you today, but you're still you. What makes the cells of your body that you have now the same body that had all different cells 10 years ago? It's the DNA. The DNA in your cells is what makes them yours and makes them you. and every cell will die and be replaced, but the DNA in the new cells is what makes them yours. So all God really needs to do to resurrect you is to keep your DNA. You know, if he has a huge data bank in his head that has the DNA of every human being, he can reconstruct, he can clone another you. He can resurrect with all new cells, a body that'll be you just as much as your body is you now. That's what I believe. So it doesn't really matter what happens to the ashes or anything like that. I mean, if it did, I mean, what are people who died 1,000 years ago and they're nothing but ashes anyway and dust? How could they be resurrected? Clearly, cremation does not inhibit God's ability to raise you, if that's your concern.
Okay. I've never thought about the idea of a DNA bank.
Yeah.
But, no, that makes perfect sense to me.
I think it does.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the answer.
All right. God bless you. I appreciate your call. All right. Rich from Everett, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
I had a question for you. Over the last few years, I've been reading a lot of material, including yours, your Revelation 4 views and other books. And, you know, my traditional churches that I came out of were very strong dispensational premillennialists.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of a view that I don't really accept anymore. I'm not sure exactly what my eschatology is now, but it's not that. And so as I read through the Bible now and I come across verses that are kind of related to, you know, the end times or eschatology, I kind of read them with a different view now, and I was wondering if I could ask your opinion on a couple of those verses.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, you know, in 1 Thessalonians 5:2, Paul talks about the day of the Lord, and he says, for yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. And he goes on to discuss that. And, you know, as I read that, it kind of seems like the day of the Lord there, I mean, that certainly could be referring to the return of Christ. That would be a day of the Lord. But that doesn't seem to necessarily be the only type of day of the Lord there is. Because when I looked in the Old Testament, I saw the day of the Lord referred to in Isaiah 13:6. That was against, I think, Babylon.
Babylon, yes. Mm-hmm.
Zephaniah 1:14, that appeared to be a day of the Lord judgment against Judah.
Yep.
So it seems like the day of the Lord could be referring to the return of Christ, or it could be referring to just some large, meaningful event that it could occur in a nation, and possibly even occurred since the writing of the canon. Maybe in the 1100s there mm-hmm. was a nation in the mm-hmm. Middle East, or the 1500s there could have been a nation in Europe.
Right.
So I look at it that way, and I'd like your opinion on that. But then when I read a little farther, I get into 2 Thessalonians 2:2. He talks about, you know, don't be quickly shaken from your composure or be disturbed by somebody telling you the day of the Lord has already come and are gathering together with him. So that kind of implies, you know, the gathering together with him, that maybe he's talking about the return of Christ. So I guess my mm-hmm. question to you is, what do you think Paul's talking about in Thessalonians 1 okay. and 2 when he talks about the day of the Lord? And how does that apply to different views of eschatology?
Okay. Well, the only people I know that would have a different view of this than that it is the second coming of Christ would be people who are full preterists, or maybe people who are partial preterists but extend their preterism further than I do, and who would think that the day of the Lord is a reference to A.D. 70 when God destroyed Jerusalem through the Roman armies. Now, you're right. The day of the Lord is a phrase that's used generically of almost any judgment of God on a nation or society. And you've found examples in the Old Testament where that's true. The day of the Lord against Jerusalem, the day of the Lord against Babylon, the day of the Lord against lots of different nations is found there. And those are all different days. Those are the days when those nations were judged and perished. Likewise, in the New Testament, it can be the case that the day of the Lord, in some instances, may refer to the particular judgment on Jerusalem. But the day of the Lord is also called, at least the term is used, the day of Christ, the day of God, the day of our Lord Jesus Christ in the New Testament, and that is in some context a reference to the second coming of Christ. I believe in 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians, the day of the Lord is a reference to the second coming of Christ for the reason you mentioned. In 2 Thessalonians 2, it is associated with our gathering together unto Christ. In 1 Thessalonians 5, it is immediately following chapter 4, which talks about the parousia, the coming of Christ, where the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout and the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first, and we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together to meet them in the clouds. In other words, I think Paul is talking to the Thessalonians about the day when the resurrection will occur, the rapture will occur, and Jesus will appear from heaven. Now, some language that sounds like the second coming is used in some passages where I believe the context would suggest it is not talking about the second coming, but talking about AD 70. However, when you read about the resurrection of the dead and the rapture of the church, which has not happened yet, I think we have to assume that this is talking about the second coming of Christ, and that that has not yet happened. So when Paul writes to the Thessalonians, I don't think he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, as some people might. For one thing, I would say this, that the day of the Lord that Paul speaks about in 1 Thessalonians 5 is sudden and unexpected. It says in verse 3, when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains. Now, you know, Jerusalem wasn't destroyed suddenly at the time when people were saying peace and safety. There was a Jewish war for 3.5 years before the destruction of Jerusalem, and no one would have called that a time of peace and safety. It was a time of rampant bloodshed, civil war, famines, horrible circumstances for a period of years before Jerusalem fell. And so when Jerusalem fell, if that was the day of the Lord, I seriously doubt that anyone was saying peace and safety, and then it suddenly came upon them. The truth is that they had, you know, of course, much warning that Jerusalem was going down. It was going down gradually at the hands of the Romans. So I don't think that Paul is describing that event. I think he's describing the second coming there.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Can I ask one kind of follow-up question to that quickly?
Okay, quickly. We're going to run out of time, so I've got another caller.
Sometimes in prophecy in the Old Testament, I think it's called the type and the anti-type, where there was a prophecy in the Old Testament, it was fulfilled, and then the prophecy is reapplied in the New Testament.
Right.
Usually to the first coming of Christ. Is there room or to look at that in Thessalonians in some similar way that, okay, if Paul's talking, and I accept that, he's talking about the return of Christ, but does this apply on a smaller scale repeated throughout history, that the same context somehow applies to countries and the circumstances? I don't know. Are there two ways of looking at it?
I mean, there are people who look at passages like this and say, well, this had a near-term fulfillment, which was a type and a shadow of a later-term fulfillment that hasn't happened yet. I'm not aware of any case in the Bible where something that happened historically was a type of something that will happen at the end of time. Like you said, most types are in the Old Testament, and they are types of the events that were fulfilled in the first coming of Christ. And therefore, I'm of the opinion that there are not any reasons, that not biblical reasons, for thinking that passages, for example, that describe the judgment of Jerusalem in AD 70, passages like, you know, the Olivet Discourse, for example, that those have a double fulfillment, you know, that the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD was a type of the end of the world. If it was, then the antitype or the fulfillment of that type would not necessarily take the same form, because types and antitypes are not exactly like anyway, but there's just no indication given that there is a secondary fulfillment. This, when Jesus comes and raises the dead and raptures the church, I don't know of any two events in history that could refer to, only one.
Awesome. Great. Hey, thanks, Steve. That's a huge help. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Okay, Rich. Thank you for your call. Kim from Gardena, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I've been reading your book and going through some of your lectures on Revelation. And for the symbolism of the two witnesses as being the church just prior to the rapture, are the 144,000 raptured up at that time?
I consider the 144,000, because I'm a partial preterist. Now, of course, I have to give that caveat, because there are four different views of Revelation, as you know from reading my book. And because I'm a partial preterist, the parts of Revelation that talk about the 144,000, which are only in two places, in Revelation 7 and in Revelation 14, I believe those passages are not talking about the end times, but they're talking about the first fruits of God. It says in Revelation 14 that the 144,000 are the first fruits unto God. And I consider that to mean the first people converted to Christ. James, in his book, in James chapter 1, says to his Jewish readers who are Christians, he says, of his own will he begat us to be a kind of first fruits of his creatures, meaning that when God began to harvest souls and bring them into the church, the Jews in Judea who came to Christ were the first fruits of that harvest. And I believe that as James and his Jewish readers, who are Christians in the first century, are said to be the first fruits, and the 144,000 are also said to be the first fruits, I believe that we are to understand that the 144,000 represent the Jewish Christians who fled from Jerusalem and escaped the Holocaust that came there in AD 70, and therefore they would not be living today or in the end times. They are early Christians from the early times, not from the last times.
Gotcha. That makes a whole lot more sense now that you straightened that out in my head. Thank you very much. Your book is excellent, and I'm learning so much. Thank you again, Steve.
All right, Kim. I appreciate your call. Thank you for calling. Steve from San Diego, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, God bless you, Steve. I'm a long-time listener. I called last year and tried a few days ago and would call late and got cut off. I would like to make two statements short and quickly and then hang up and listen to your comment.
Okay.
Yeah, your statements and view is about 90% accurate with the Bible. One thing I disagree that was recently mentioned and often repeated, that first sacrifice God made when he took the skin and clothed Adam, nowhere in the Bible state that. Sacrifice of the Old Testament is very similar to prayer of the New Testament. God didn't sacrifice to himself, and even less to Adam. God, who spoke the word and created everything, it's much easier to create only skin or tuxedo or whatever he would like to. So I believe that he created clothing for Adam and Eve without killing or sacrificing animals. Number two is often mentioned Lazarus and rich man. That he was, Lazarus from the grave that was raised.
Yeah.
And that he had to die again. Nowhere in the Bible we find that. We find that the Bible states it is appointed for man once to die and then judgment. We have two cases that I'm aware of, and maybe more, that death was omitted to seven men from Adam, Enoch, and Elijah. And I know, or believe so, the Bible supports, that they were changed in a twinkling of the eye. In other words, didn't go through the pain and thing of death. But flesh and blood, the Bible states, cannot see the kingdom of God or go to heaven. Okay? God bless you. I will hang and listen.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Now, with reference to God does not offer a sacrifice himself, I'm not sure you're correct. When Abraham and Isaac were going up the hill where Isaac, unbeknown to himself, was to be sacrificed, Isaac said, Father, here's the wood and here's the fire, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham prophesied and said, my son, the Lord will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering. And it is understood by most Christians, and I think even the passage suggests it, that this was a prophecy about God providing a sacrifice for himself. In fact, in Christ, the lamb that would be provided for sacrifice. Now, every sacrifice that man ever offered was provided by God, because all good gifts and every perfect gift comes from God. If a man had a lamb or a goat or a bull to sacrifice, in the final analysis, that was a gift from God. Everything we have is from God. So God does provide the sacrifices. Now, the animal skins that were used to cover Adam and Eve's nakedness, you said God could just speak them into existence. Of course he could, but then they wouldn't be animal skins. They'd be leather, but they wouldn't be the skins of any animals, because there had never been any animals wearing them. If for something to be the skins of animals, you'd pretty much have to have they once covered an animal's body. God could create leather or a fleece, perhaps. I mean, certainly he could with just a word. But that wouldn't really be the skin of an animal. It'd be a fleece. It'd be a piece of leather that uniquely was created without any animal there. It would never have been a skin of an animal. So I think that the fact that God provided skins means he had to remove them from an animal, or else they weren't skins of an animal. And therefore, there was a shedding of blood. And that God would do this to cover sin, again, is not uncharacteristic of him, since Abraham himself said that God would provide a lamb. And we know that even on the, in that story, God provided a ram in the thicket that Abraham sacrificed. But more than that, God provided his son as a lamb for himself as a sacrifice. So I'm going to disagree with you on that, of course. Of course, you said I'm right, 90%. Maybe it's up to 95% now. But then the other question you had was about whether Lazarus and others who had died and risen again ever had to die again. You're basing your denial of it on the statement, it is appointed unto man once to die, but after this the judgment. But then you yourself admit there are exceptions, because you quoted Enoch and Elijah as exceptions. They didn't die. And we can have more, because Jesus, Paul said, when Jesus returns, those who are alive and remain at the coming of the Lord will be caught up together to meet him in the air. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, we shall not all die. We shall all be changed. So there are people, there certainly are numerous exceptions that the Bible acknowledges to the general statement, it's appointed unto man once to die. The statement is general. People that Elijah and Elisha raised from the dead in the Old Testament probably died again. If they didn't, they would have still been living at about 700 years old or so in the time of Jesus. And I don't know how old they'd be now, of course, if they're still on the earth. But I think that those who raised from the dead, unless they were glorified in their bodies, and we have no evidence that Lazarus was, or Jairus' daughter, or the son of the widow of Nain that Jesus raised, or, Dorcas, whom Peter raised from the dead, or Eutychus, whom Paul raised, we have no reason to believe they're still alive somewhere on the earth today. So I think I'm 100% there, but we can always disagree. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, keep us on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and help out. And I'm also speaking in Buena Park this weekend. Look at our website, thenarrowpath.com, for details.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
And we appreciate you listening to The Narrow Path right here on KBRite, serving God and country throughout Southern California. I'm Rob Newton. Enjoying Everyday Life with Joyce Meyer is speaking about making good habits and breaking those bad habits that you all have. All of you, condemned. That's all of us. Everyone has a bad habit, right? But we should make good habits that will help battle the bad habits. So stay right here on KBRite to learn more.
It's time to celebrate. In honor of moving into our new facilities on Airway Avenue in Costa Mesa, Gooing Chiropractic is offering a one-time full-body health exam for only $29.99 for all patients. Begin to identify the root of a chronic problem and tour the new facilities to learn why Dr. Mike Gooing was named one of the top 27 curative chiropractors in the U.S. That means he doesn't just crack backs. He finds solutions to ongoing issues toward affecting a cure. He uses non-traditional chiropractic methods, quantum reflex analysis, laser therapy for inflammation and joint pain, and nutrition that really works. So what have you got to lose? Give us a call at 714-556-9188, 714-556-9188, and ask about our grand opening special for only $29.99, 714-556-9188.
This is KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, KNSN San Diego, and 100.7 in Corona, serving all counties in all of Southern California, and on the web at KBRightRadio.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled, Making Good Habits, Breaking Bad Habits. Have you ever thought about why you do certain things? Most decisions that you make can be the result of a habit that you made. Good habits bring great rewards, like staying healthy or living a joyful life. Bad habits might leave you feeling depressed or even harm you. Sometimes it might feel that the habit controls you rather than you controlling the habit. that's not the truth. With God, you can control your habits, and if you make a good habit, it can even help you break some of your bad ones. Be encouraged today as Joyce explains the nature of habits and steps to develop good ones. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Making Good Habits, Breaking Bad Habits.
Sometimes if you want to make a good habit, you need to have reminders. One of my daughters, her name is Sandra. She's our youngest daughter. She's not just mine. She's Dave's, too. I act like these are all my kids. You know me, the choleric personality. It's mine. Everything's mine. So her love language, I don't know if you know what a love language is. That means it's the way that people speak to you that make you feel loved. And different peoples are different. Some people, you give them a gift, they feel loved. Some people, you give them a compliment, and they feel loved. Well, we normally try to give people what we need, but most of the time it's not what they need, so they feel like we're not giving.